Welcome to the CX Chronicles podcast. This is the show for customer service managers, VPs of customer experience, and all of you other CXers out there. Every week, we are going to dig into topics, challenges, wins, and updates in the CX and customer service community. I'm your host, Adrian Brady Chisana. Check us out at cxchronicles.com. Feel free to reach out to us anytime. Thank you so much for being a part of the CX Chronicles Nation.
I'm super excited for today's show as we welcome Roger Dooley, an author, keynote speaker, podcast host, a Forbes contributor, a friction hunter, and an avid Texas barbecue fan. Roger has a wealth of knowledge and a ton of experience around building businesses and thinking about what drives customers. He has experience speaking all over the world, writing books, leading and guiding training seminars and workshops, and working with a ton of amazing customers and businesses along the way. Roger's newest book, Friction, just hit the bookshelves. He's also written another book that some of you have probably read called Brainfluence, thinking about neuromarketing and how it affects consumer behavior. Roger's also the host of the Brainfluence podcast, and if you haven't listened to it, I highly suggest that you check it out right away. Guys, without further ado, I'd like to welcome Roger Dooley to the CX Chronicles podcast.
Zendesk, the platform where all the action is. Do you need help with customer interactions across phone, chat, email, social media, and any other channel that you can imagine? All coming together in one place. Ask CX Chronicles how Zendesk can help your business today.
Hey, Roger, thanks so much for joining the CX Chronicles podcast.
Well, happy to be here, Adrian. Thank you.
Absolutely, Roger. I'm super excited to have you on the show today. You and I have had some awesome chats leading up to today's show. I'm really, really excited for you to come on, talk with the CX Nation, not only about your entrepreneurial story, but about all these awesome things that you've done with the books that you've written and just with all the cool things that you're doing with your speaking engagements and your podcast. So I'm really excited for today's show, Roger.
Well, me too. Should be a lot of fun.
So I would love for you to start off, as we start all these wonderful shows off with, tell the CX Nation your elevator pitch. Let us know how you found your way into working inside of customer experience and working with customers and doing all this awesome stuff around how you get people to think about better ways that they can kind of grow, run, and manage their businesses today.
Right. Well, assuming we're not on a 100-floor elevator ride here, I'll try and keep it really simple, Adrian. The last dozen years or so, I've been writing about using behavioral science to market better and to do better business. Along the way, I saw both BJ Fogg's behavior model that says you need three things to get somebody to either change or act out a behavior, and that's motivation, a trigger, and ability. And ability in his scheme means lack of difficulty or ease of doing it. And over time, I realized that this was a really interesting topic because so often our customer experience situations are damaged by just difficulty. I mean, I have so many times I've tried to place an order someplace, but I've just gotten bogged down in filling out their form, or for some reason it wants a piece of information that I don't have, or I've got to go fish out a credit card because for some reason their website won't let my browser fill it in for me. Yep. You know, all these things that happen, and these are often the easiest and cheapest things to fix because back to Fogg's model, you can try and increase motivation too. I mean, I guarantee you, if you are trying to sell stuff, you can sell more stuff if you give your customers big discounts or if you give them other stuff, free shipping, free products, and so on. Unfortunately, all that costs money. It's usually expensive to increase motivation. Now, I do spend a lot of my time writing about more psychological motivators that aren't really that expensive. But nevertheless, I became fascinated with this idea of friction and making things easier, getting friction out of the processes of both customer experience and even internal employee experience. And so that's brought me to my latest book, which oddly enough is called Friction.
That's awesome. And you know, Roger, you're right. It's like if you're not removing friction, and if you're not taking the time to think about how you can slowly, you know, either remove or sort of push down any of the blockers that make something easy, convenient, and seamless for a customer, you're already a little bit behind, right? So I love that you're kind of thinking about that. I have to ask though, what made you get interested in this idea of neuromarketing? What sort of drew you to that whole space?
Yeah, you know, well, I've been, I started off life as an engineer and transitioned after just a few years into more of a corporate executive path. And when I was about 30, I was in charge of strategic planning for a Fortune 1000 company. And I really thought my career was taking off. And so I brilliantly chose that moment to bail out of the corporate world and become an entrepreneur.
Nice.
And since that time, I've had a variety of entrepreneurial ventures, had a direct marketing business for a very long time in the early days of home computers. Subsequent to that, more digitally oriented businesses. Somehow along the way, I just saw that neuroscience and marketing were coming together. I began reading a little bit about that, and I said, oh, that's kind of interesting. So I registered a domain, and I started writing some little blog posts there just to sort of create some content on it. And I found that other people were interested in this topic too. So I, as I got more feedback, I began writing more and also let my readers guide me. And I found that they were most interested in actionable advice, not really hearing what the big brands were doing so much as advice that they could use regardless of the size of company they were with. And so I sort of gravitated away a little bit from the sort of pure neuroscience into more behavioral science because, at least at that time, that was more broadly applicable. In other words, if you wanted to do neuromarketing studies on your ad, you know, that might cost you tens of thousands of dollars, which many small companies just couldn't justify.
Yep.
But, you know, anybody can incorporate the principles of influence and persuasion as initially articulated by Bob Cialdini, as well as many of the other thinkers out there on that. And really, it doesn't cost anything. It's more a mindset when you're looking at your advertising and saying, okay, we can include some of these things that will make our ads, our marketing perform better. And so that's how I got into this direction, which then ultimately led me to this study of friction.
That's awesome. And it's funny because, you know, Roger, I think the average customer, I don't know if they really take the time to stop and think when they look at a message, right? They think they see some type of a commercial or a marketing message or an ad in a newspaper or magazine. It's funny. You got to wonder, do people stop and take the time to think about the science behind what's drawing them to that ad, what's making them maybe look at the words one, two, three times, what's making them literally trigger all the messages in their brain to actually compute whatever that message is. It's funny. I wonder how many people actually, you know, stop and take the time to think about that. And it's funny when someone like you, you've spent a ton of time thinking about this. You've written books on the matter. And it's just a really interesting thing for our listeners to think about when you're trying to capture an audience or you're trying to grab a potential customer's attention. What are some of the things that you need to do to kind of get there? It's really, really interesting to think about.
Well, yeah, you know, and I think most people, as you say, Adrian, are not aware of that. And that's probably a good thing because most people don't sit there and analyze the ads that they're attracted to. But I mean, I think that our listeners, if they can just imagine a typical travel ad from Expedia or Booking.com or something, someplace like that, you will find their website and ads for hotels and flights and such filled with these sort of non-conscious cues to encourage you to act. know, you'll see that there's only two seats left on this at this price. And that is a classic scarcity ploy that dates all the way back to Bob Cialdini 30 plus years ago when he first wrote about that. But these companies really get it. Something else they do is show you, wow, there's 25 people that booked this hotel in the last 24 hours. That's social proof, another Cialdini principle. Yep. And, you know, you could pick apart their entire page and find all these examples of that. And now the average consumer isn't aware of that, but all of these things are sort of getting them on this slippery slope that's saying, I better click that button and book that room right now or book that flight right now.
Yep, no, it's spot on, and it's so funny the pushes and the gentle nudges that we get online today from all these companies around how to make that purchase quicker or just get into that buy so that we kind of feel like we're not missing out, right? It's really funny how they set that type of motivation. So Roger, I have a question for you. Before we hop into talking through some of the pillars, I'd love to just ask you with your books, with Brainfluence and with Friction, when you set out to write these different books, what were some of the big drawing features that you, that A, made you know that you needed to put together a book on the topic, and B, where did you start? Because a lot of people listening to the show, we're always thinking about content creation, new ways that we can build out written content, video content for our businesses. Where did you start when it came to putting together your books?
Well, you know, I really struggled, particularly with the first book, with Brainfluence, because I had some interest. First of all, I knew that I wanted to write a book, and I had a publisher who wanted me to write a book. So that part was kind of foregone. But I struggled at the start to say, by writing a book that started off with a sort of a discussion of how the brain works, and then I figured I'd ease into some of the specific techniques after that. And I really struggled. I kind of went down that road for a month or two and just could not get the content flowing. And finally, I decided that I'd try a different approach. And so I figured, you know, people like short, actionable content. They like to see something they can read relatively quickly, understand it, and then have a takeaway that they can act on. So I completely threw out my original outline and chapter list and instead said, okay, I'm going to write 100 short chapters that each one will have a little bit of scientific research in it, just a little bit of discussion, and then here's how you translate that into something actionable for your business. And once I hit that realization, it's really started to flow. Up to that point, I was struggling, but once I said, okay, this is how I can do this. And so I began pouring content into more like different buckets, saying, okay, well, I've got ideas for nonprofits in this section, and here's some content for people who are writing headlines or creating content and that sort of thing. So after that, it began to flow quickly, and I managed to crank the book out in a relatively short time. But boy, up to that point, it was a struggle. With Friction, the process was a little bit different. I had sort of a rough idea of what I wanted to write about, and initially the focus was just about completely on customer experience, because that was my starting point, and how can we make customer experience better, but also how can we convert better? I came to this really out of conversion thinking of, okay, you've got people coming to your website or opening up your app. How do you get, you know, X percent more of them to place an order or to turn into a lead or whatever you want them to do? But as I thought about it, I realized that these same things prevent work from getting done inside companies. You know, some of those same factors not only affect customer experience and customer engagement, but they affect the experience of team members and their engagement. And even from there, began looking at how it affects our personal habits. If you want to adopt a habit, make it easier. If you want to break a habit or stop eating so many candies or something, make it more difficult. And even finally, I took it all the way to the difference in regional success. Just today, I've posted a new podcast with a writer who is an expert on the Indian economy. In the book, I talk about how India and China were the same size economy-wise, 30 years ago. And today, China's 8 times as big. And a big reason is because of the horrendous friction in India's processes for business, especially in the earlier part of that era. It was almost impossible for somebody, an entrepreneur, to start a business in India. There were so many hurdles and roadblocks and approvals and, you know, perhaps in some cases, corrupt politicians or bureaucrats they had to pay off. But it was incredibly difficult. And entrepreneurs typically went in two directions. They either went underground into the off-the-books economy, which is okay, but you can't really scale in that area, or they just left the country to go someplace else. And there are many successful Indian entrepreneurs around the world who I think would have done what they wanted to do in India had it been a little bit easier.
That's a great point, and exactly right, where sometimes that friction causes restrictions, right? And whether it's a global economy, whether it's an organization, or whether it's a small little startup, that's why being aware of where your friction points are, being aware of what does slow you down, slow your team down, slow your customer down, those are the things that you got to get up every single solitary morning and figure out how to sort of smooth that out, right? And make it easier, make it cleaner, make it simpler. So all awesome stuff.
Roger. Right, but from pure content process, that kind of made it more difficult, though, because the more I worked on it, sort of the more the number of domains I was trying to research expanded. So that was a bit of a challenge. And then to get the thing down to a manageable size after that.
I bet that's the case. Roger, I'd love to move our conversation into the four CX pillars. As you know, we spend a ton of time on the CX Chronicles talking about team, tools, process, and feedback. And you've got some awesome experience. You've worked at an executive level at a huge company. You've had a number of your own businesses. I'd love for you to take a couple minutes to talk about that first pillar of team. Talk with the CX Nation about some of the things you've sort of learned along your journey that you got to really keep in your front pocket when it comes to thinking about team structure and organization.
Right. Well, you know, it's probably obvious to everybody, but the team has to understand that it is the customer that pays the bills, and they really have to sort of start their day and end their day with that in mind, that they have to focus on that customer experience, and that they are not there to necessarily enforce the rules of the company. You know, and not that you can have people just going willy-nilly doing whatever they want. But you know, we've all had that experience where we're talking to a customer service rep trying to resolve a problem, and we just can't get it resolved because, well, this is our policy, or I can't do that. You've got to talk to somebody else. And you know, if people can start with the attitude that our job is to make things as easy as possible for the customer. You know, if we are the people who are developing a website or the mobile app, we have to make it incredibly simple and easy to understand, in eliminating as many steps as possible in the process. If we are in that front line of customer service people who are perhaps handling orders or perhaps customer inquiries or problem solving, we have to think not just of this is how we do things. These are our procedures, and we'll make our customers conform to that. But how can we solve this problem, or how can we accomplish whatever the customer wants to accomplish as simply and easily as possible? Because the research that I've seen shows that the biggest factor in customer loyalty is having a very low effort experience, particularly in problem resolution. That's for years, long even before the internet and e-commerce, I've heard that you can really tell what a company's like when you have a problem to solve. You know, like if you place an order and you get your order and everything's fine, okay, that's fine. You know, everything's good. But when you have a problem, that's when the company really shows their true colors. You know, if they make you jump through hoops to solve it, or if they go really out of their way to make it easy for you to solve, that's where you develop customer loyalty. And the more recent data in our digital era pretty much shows that customers who have low effort problem solving experiences are like 94% likely to repurchase compared to just 4% of high effort customers. So, I mean, if you want to talk about loyalty, then that differential is just staggering, and it all relates to whether people had an easy experience or a difficult experience. And I think the important thing, Adrian, is that it is their perception of that experience that counts. So you may think, well, we've got the best process in the industry. You know, we're better than our competitors at this. But they're probably not comparing you to your competitors. They're probably comparing you to Amazon or to Uber or somebody like that. And if they perceive that you're making them work hard, then it's an effortful experience for them.
Absolutely. I was literally just going to say, you know, the Ubers, the Amazons of the world, whether you love them or you hate them, man, do they make it easy for you to use their product and their services. It's as simple as a click and a swipe, and then the entire experience from a digital perspective is just so easy, so clean, so simple. The tracking inside of it, the visibility inside of it, it's all set up to be frictionless, Roger. And that's a huge part of why they've seen the success that they've had.
Right. And you recall Amazon bought Zappos some years back, and in part it was because of the customer experience that Zappos was providing. Amazon wanted that type of feeling to pervade their company and their own people. I don't know if there was really, they could justify the $1 billion price tag in terms of the number of pairs of shoes they were going to sell. But in terms of merging those cultures, that was what was really important to them, I think.
Absolutely. No, completely agree. Roger, moving to the second pillar of tools. Talk with us a little bit about, from all the research you've done and all the work you've done with these different companies, what have you seen to work really well when it comes to business executives, business owners, or leaders thinking about what toolkit they want to put in front of their team or they want to put in front of their employees to manage their customers each day?
Right. Well, for starters, Adrian, I think that the most important thing that any company can do is, and this doesn't depend on a specific tool necessarily, but is observe their customers as they go through the various processes that they have to, whether it's placing an order online or resolving a problem. You know, I have so many experiences where I'm frustrated and I finally end up just saying, did anybody ever watch a customer go through this for the first time? Yep. Because, you know, clearly, if you do something for a while or if you design the process, it's not difficult for you. You know, there are a lot of things that we learn how to do that we don't even have to think about. But if somebody else is doing them for the first time, they might struggle with it. And that's what you have to do. There's different ways you can do that. You can actually watch customers, say, in a lab setting. You can interview customers. Self-reporting isn't great, but sometimes it can tell you, give you some objective information at least. You can use tools like user testing to get basically people who have not seen whatever you want them to do before, use your website or use your app, go through it and record what their thinking is as they're experiencing it. And I think there's a limitation of those services where at some point these novice users almost get to be expert testers, because if they are doing this for at least a part-time job, pretty soon they may have checked out dozens or even hundreds of websites and apps. And at that point, even if they started out as a novice user, by the time they get to yours, they're probably going to have a little bit easier time finding that buy button or figuring out what to do where, you know, if you gave it to your mother, say, she might still struggle with it. So, you know, try it out with your mother. That would be a good one.
That's a good task.
But I mean, that's a tool those types of tools you can use. And there are a million tools for measuring and recording consumer behavior. You know, how long are they on a particular page? How many times do they have to search before they end up with a search result they want? Do they have to reword their search phrase three times because your smart suggestions aren't smart enough? Are they clicking on things that are not clickable, which is an indication that there's something confusing about your interface? And using click tracking tools, there's eye tracking tools and some pretty good ones that you can see exactly what people are looking at and determine, you know, are they pretty much following the flow that you expect them to? Or are they hunting around for what you think they should be looking at right away? There are facial coding tools that will measure people's facial expressions while they're, say, using your app or website. And you can see if people are perplexed, confused, if they're showing disgust on their face, which is one of the sort of basic emotions that's measured. If that's the case, your experience is not as good as it could be. So, to me, those are the kinds of things, any of those tools to see how people are really using your stuff, because I think that so many companies make the mistake of saying, okay, I've been designing systems like this for years. We know what these customers are going to do. And we're going to design it so that it's really easy for them without actually testing it on real people to see how easy it is.
Absolutely. It's like once you take whatever it is that you think you've got locked and loaded and ready to roll and you put it into the real world, human beings can all of a sudden have a very different set of reactions. They can have a very different set of behaviors around what you initially assumed to be the case. So really, really, really interesting points. The other thing too, Roger, that you just made me think about, in terms of watching those customer behaviors, you talked about a number of different examples of tools that helps you to do that. But for our listeners, there's so many different ways you can do this inside of your business right now today without any of those tools, right? In terms of seeing how they use the product, getting feedback around how they actually use the product or the service, spending time with the team that actually is servicing or selling your products and services, see how the customer behaves with it. There's all of these really easy things that you can do to get a better handle on what seems to make your customers tick and what seems to be the big opportunities for what you can provide them to really, really push and grow your business into the future.
Yeah, well, I think doing something is the important part. It's not even so much the selection of the tool. Like, certain tools may be better for certain kinds of tasks, of course, but it's not so much which tool. It's that you're thinking about it and thinking about how are real customers doing this and trying to measure that behavior. And once you start adopting that mindset, then you'll find those bottlenecks and those blockers and eliminate them.
Absolutely. And you know what? And Roger, that's an awesome segue into the third pillar of process. So I would love for you to spend a few minutes kind of talking about how you've personally kind of gone about thinking about building or optimizing your company or your team's process or workflows, and especially with you constantly thinking about some of the science behind what makes people tick, whether it's your customers or whether it's your employees. I'd love for you to spend a little bit of time talking about sort of what you've seen work really well when it comes down to establishing processes and workflows to keep the trains on the track each and every day.
Yeah, well, I think that in some ways, the people who can better tell you that are the ones who are doing the using your current processes. One thing that I've seen is when I talk about friction in customer experience, people start seeing and provide a bunch of examples. People start seeing friction everywhere. And first, it's in their own customer experience, whether they're the customer or they're saying, well, gee, I can see how our customers might find this confusing. But pretty soon, they start to see it in other aspects of their life where, why do we have to do this thing this way? When I'm renewing my driver's license or something, boy, they could have taken 5 steps out of this without losing anything.
I do that every day, Roger. Every day of my life, I'm like, why didn't they do
once
this?
Once you develop that, and then also they start seeing it in their own internal processes because companies are full of inefficiencies. And, too often managers think that their primary task is to, keep their team members on task and productive and avoid distractions and just keep them working, when often they could get far more productivity by eliminating stuff, by not making people go to meetings that aren't necessary, either necessary for them or sometimes necessary at all, by ensuring that email is used effectively and that people aren't sending out giant distributions in every email and just cluttering up people's inboxes. There was an article in Harvard Business Review not too long ago that estimated that U.S. businesses alone waste $3 trillion every year in what the authors called organizational drag. And organizational drag is really sort of another name for friction. And it's just what I've been talking about. Bad processes, rules that people have to follow that slow them down. All these things, and of course, meetings and emails. The amount of time people spend on email is staggering. I've seen some estimates that it can be more than 2 hours a day on email. An even worse statistic is that on average, managers have something like 6.5 hours available per week for more or less uninterrupted work. Out of maybe a 40 to 50 hour actual work week, the rest of their time is taken up with meetings and email and distractions. And so their ability to get that sort of important thinking work done is almost impossible because even in that 6 hours, you know that they're going to get interrupted from time to time. And I think the best thing that people can do with processes is find, first of all, which processes can be eliminated completely, and often asking your own people that. Ask people to nominate something that they're doing that is wasting their time, or a rule that they're following that really doesn't need to be a rule at all. And sometimes what you find is when you ask for, what's the dumbest rule we have in our company, you find that people are following what they thought was a rule, and it isn't even a rule at all. It's just that, well, gee, the person before me did that, or, we've always done it that way. And just assume that that's how it had to be done. And when you start streamlining this stuff, that's where you really see the benefits in the process. And it's really a two-for-one benefit because, first of all, when people aren't wasting their time, they're more productive. But I think even more importantly, team members are going to be more engaged when they perceive both that you care about them wasting their time and avoiding unnecessary work, and you're helping them do that, you're helping them get rid of that stuff, and also that they're not spending time on stuff that is not contributing either to helping the customer, helping themselves, or helping the company, because that's not very motivating. If you know that you're performing a task and it's going to take, you're going to work on that task for the next 30 minutes, but that it's not really important or even essential for the company, but you've got to do it because that's the way it is, that is not motivating. You will become more disengaged. There's a really scary number that like more than two-thirds of U.S. employees are not engaged with their employer, that, they don't really feel engaged. They're either just kind of neutral, like, not engaged, or then there are some who are actively disengaged, which means that, at that point, they're probably looking for another job or trying to figure out what the heck they're doing at that company. This, I think one big reason is because of bad processes. When people are forced to do stuff that is wasting their time, they feel, A, the company doesn't care about them, and, so why should they care about the company?
Yep. So, look, you brought up a number of awesome points there. I think there's a few follow-ons that I want to kind of poke on here, Roger. The first is you brought up this idea of it is absolutely crazy how few hours leaders and managers have inside of their week. You just said it yourself, right? 6.5 hours to actually do thinking work out of a 50-hour week, right? And I know, Roger, everybody listening knows exactly what we're talking about right there. You're just so damn busy with the meetings that many times you literally want to just drag yourself right out of the room because it's like, oh my God, we're talking about this again. We've talked about it 5 times already. What's going on? There's that. The other thing is just some of that busy work that, it might be annoying, it might be daunting, but I get some of that busy work is it's required, it's mandatory to keep the trains on the track and run the day-to-day operations. I understand it. But I want to give it some extra ideas here that you sort of started to poke on, which is, it's important for the listeners of our show as leaders of your business and more importantly, as customer-minded business leaders, you need to know when and where you can carve out times where there is no distractions. Distraction-free zones is what I've always kind of jokingly called them with my team. This can be a series of times in your day where maybe there's no meetings allowed. Maybe from 2 to 4 on a Tuesday, there's no meetings allowed. Everyone's expected to do nothing but do their thinking time or do their customer portfolio management time. That's one idea. Another idea that you made me think about, Roger, was you called it, what was it, operational drag? Or
organizational drag.
Organizational drag. That's super fascinating because I know my Six Sigma friends, they would call that some of the waste management, right? You have to look at any given process, any given workflow. where is the waste? Where is there things that we're maybe spending time, money, energy, or putting someone's attention on that we can, if we just pared it back a little bit across the course of a quarter or 12 months or whatever that looks like, you've just saved a number of money, a number of hours, et cetera. So all really, really interesting points there.
And right. Well, the Japanese call that muda, which is their term in the Kaizen process for waste, wasted motion, wasted effort. And, you know, they were originally thinking about that in terms of manufacturing processes and how a, say, an assembly line worker could be more efficient by having the material placed correctly and having the tool in the right position and so on. But, I mean, that applies to everybody and in, perhaps even more so to white-collar people who are doing office tasks, because they are, their activities are often filled with that same kind of waste. It's just not quite as obvious.
Absolutely.
Because you can't, you know, you can videotape a worker at a station and see where there might be wasted effort, but you can't really do that with somebody who's sitting at a computer screen. But that waste is still there.
Absolutely, it is. We all see it every single day. Roger, that's awesome. I'd like to move into the fourth pillar, feedback. And this is one that I'm really interested to pick your brain on, Roger, because you've done a ton of investigation and a ton of deep dives into what makes not just people tick, but you've done a ton of thinking and research around what makes customers tick. So let's start with the first part. With customer feedback, talk with us about some of the things that you've sort of identified, not only in the writing of your books, but also with just building and growing your own companies.
Okay, in terms of trying to get the right kind of feedback from customers?
Sorry, let me clarify 2 points. So the first thing is talk to us about some ideas for what's worked really well to get that feedback from customers.
Okay.
And then the second part, Roger, what did you do with it?
Right, okay. Well, I think that you know, we look for simple, quantifiable solutions when we're asking, we're trying to get customer feedback. So we've got the tools like Net Promoter Score that tells you, you know, ask a simple question or two to see if customers would recommend you, say, and there's a customer effort score and some other stuff. But often the way we get these things are super annoying, and you end up getting non-representative answers, because I know many times I go to a website with a very specific intention in mind. I want to place an order or I want to get some product information. And the very first thing I see is one of these pop-ups that say, would you be willing to answer a survey when you're done here? And that is blocking me from what I want to do. And so all I do is close it as quickly as I can. I'm already irritated that I had to grab my mouse and close this stupid thing, you know, when that was unnecessary. But when I've spoken at large conferences, I put up one of those pop-ups on my screen and said, okay, how many people see these? And like everybody's hand goes up. I say, okay, how many people have ever actually said, yes, I'll fill it out? And like nobody raises their hand.
Yep.
You know, the only people that are going to fill that out are those that either have some kind of an axe to grind because you really irritated them, or they have like way too much time on their hands and, you know, would relish even that simple little interaction with your form. So, you know, these tools, I think, are very limited. You know, it's not that you shouldn't do them, but ask people at the right time. You know, if you can ask people after they've had an experience, if they'll share some information, and by all means, you know, make it simple. I got a survey. I stayed at a hotel the other day when I was at a speech, and they asked, you know, well, tell us about your stay. So, okay. What they sent me to a form, or not a form, a whole process that had, I think, about a dozen screens with maybe 1 to 4 questions per screen. Quite a few of the questions had like maybe a number from 1 to 10 that I was supposed to choose. And, you know, the only reason I went through that process was to see how ridiculous it was. Because again, when you make people go through and you ask questions about every aspect of their experience, you know, by the time they get to the third page, they're going to be bailing out like crazy because, you know, they don't have the time for this. It's too much effort.
CX Chronicles wants to thank Roger Dooley for coming on the podcast. Be sure to check out his awesome new book, Friction, the untapped force that can be your most powerful advantage. Friction's a multi-trillion-dollar problem. It frustrates customers, costing you sales, reducing loyalty, and creating negative word of mouth. Inside your organization, it destroys productivity, it reduces employee engagement, and it increases turnover. in friction, you'll learn how to spot it, how to eliminate it, and occasionally use it to your advantage. So thanks again, Roger, for coming on the show. And folks, make it a great week. You can learn more about Roger at rogerdooley.com or find Roger on LinkedIn. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of CX Chronicles. Be sure to subscribe, save, and share with all of your fellow CXers. And until next time, make happiness a habit, CX Chronicles Nation. Check us out at cxchronicles.com.